I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Van Morrison here on a Friday.
Help me show my love. From the block and lovely street.
To the bright side of the road. And joining me from the bright side of the road is Mr. Brightside himself, the All Marine Radio head chef, Kim Holmes. Kim, good Friday morning to you. How you doing?
Good morning, Mac. Good morning, Marines everywhere.
Anyway, we did a little tribute to Jim Lehrer, who for years was half of the McNeil
yes.
Lehrer news report that many of us grew up watching. And to be honest, was just a great example to everybody about, you know, the role journalism can play if it's done well, and incredibly proud, you know, that he's
yes.
you know, that he's a Marine, and we get that he's part of our tribe. So and I know you watched him. As most people
all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude had major game.
Yes, he did.
Right. And you know what? And the thing I loved about that show is that, you know, they were respectful and they argued and you know, and they played point counterpoint and but it was always articulate and respectful. And I think the nation sorely misses him as a professionalism. And what was McNeil's first name? I can't remember his first name.
Jim
McNeil. So, they would bring other people, other like-minded professionals. And when I say like-minded, I don't mean that their opinions necessarily matched. I mean their approach to journalism matched in terms of respectful, articulate. And that was why it was always such a, in my opinion, popular and awesome show. So, anyway,
there were so many good. Journalists back then, reporters and Walter Cronkite.
But you know, most of those guys though delivered the news, right? And then these guys were the first that I can recall. They were other than the Sunday morning talk shows, but on a daily basis, they roundtabled news, right? And didn't
yes.
just report it. They were the first ones to do that. And it was, as I've said, they were off the hook. They were off the hook good. And so
good.
Yeah. And so too bad other people don't take cues from them. What's going on, man? First of all, give us a weather report. What's going on with the weather? Is it still real cold? Is it warmed up a little bit?
No, it's beautiful.
Oh, yay.
It's in the 20s to 30 degrees during the day.
Love that.
It's no snow. It's kind of foggy today for a couple of days, but the sun was out yesterday. It was beautiful, about 25, 27 degrees. I loved it. We're getting a little break before for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then we're going to have one more crunching blow on our back for a week or so, and then then we're heading into
summer.
Nice weather.
The
not summer, but warmer weather. You're in North Dakota when you say, "Oh, it's a mild day, 25 above," and I'm just laughing, going, "Yeah, that this is the only place they say that."
Right.
They wouldn't say in Florida or anywhere in the lower Midwest that. You know, 25 was mild and nice.
right. The
yeah.
Wait, I just had a comment to say. Now, what you heard Kim too, just talking about, you know, we're gonna have one more down into the deep freeze, and then that's called whistling past the graveyard. Okay.
Yeah.
That's called Whistling Past the Graveyard. Maybe if I say it, maybe it will act, maybe we'll only get one. That's the thing that I used to hate was, like, towards April, like, come on now, we've done it enough, don't you think? And then you go back and you do that, and you're like, what? Come on. Enough already. So, anyway.
We had 97, we had our last blizzard in April 8th.
April. Everybody heard that,
April
right.
8th. April 8th. And then the flood hit about 10 days later.
Yeah,
but
the blizzard.
You can't, and that was the last of 8 blizzards. And I mean blizzards, not 3 or 4 inches. I'm talking 8 to 2 feet. 8 inches to 2 feet with wind, which double downs everything. So you know what
everybody's thinking? And like, okay, so yeah. tell us again why you live there, oh great one.
Oh, because of the weather.
You know,
and if you believe that shit, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn for you to buy too.
You know what?
Cheap.
You would
real cheap.
You would hear people say stuff like that, right? You know, well,
yeah.
Why do you stay here in the Midwest? Well, you know, the people are wonderful, but it's really the weather that keeps me here, right? And you know, all of a sudden the head snaps. Like, what did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the weather. That's why I stay here. Okay.
Well, if I could afford it and my wife wanted to, I would move to Arizona, the Mesa area in a heartbeat.
Really?
But Beth loves it here. She's from here.
Oh, she's from, yeah. Miss
B. Our condo is almost paid off.
Ooh.
You know, we got 2 or 3 more years,
then you,
and it'll be free and clear.
Then you'll be double tunned up. Right now, you're just like tunned up,
well,
right?
I just want to live.
Kim drives his car down the street.
I don't care about being tunned up.
Oh,
I just want to be comfortable.
He drives down the street, and like $100 bills are flying out the windows and shit like that. And you're like, hey, who's that? Did John Rockefeller show up? And like, oh, no, that's Kim Holmes. You're like, oh, damn. Big man, got a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, my balcony overlooks 3rd Street, where most of the bars and restaurants are in Grand Forks, the locally owned ones.
Yeah.
And so when it's paid off, I'll just sit out there in the summer and make paper airplanes out of $100 bills and fly them off the balcony.
Shovel money into the street.
Oh, hell yes.
Well, just so you know, when Kim's building opened up, they were called the Elite Brownstone.
Yes. Yeah, they were.
Did
I get a lot of shit from Mr. McNamara about, Mr. Elite.
Mr.
Can I touch you? Can I come to see your apartment?
Yeah.
I mean your palace.
The palace at the Elite Brownstones. Hey. Yeah.
Elite.
Oh, really? You're going to move into the Elite. Yeah. He had Kim had a cool pad above his old restaurant.
That was fun.
Yeah, he had. He lived on top of the building, and it was what, 3 story, 4 stories, 3 story?
No, 2 story building. And I was going to put a third floor and a bedroom and a nice patio, but the flood came and dashed those plans.
Right. But I went to, that's where I, the house, the first time I, you know, went to Kim's house, but it was cool.
Yep.
I mean, it had this long, I don't know how many steps on the metal staircase. So it had this metal staircase affixed to the outside of the building. How many steps on it?
Oh, about 340.
And so you can imagine that thing frozen in the winter, and it dropped, that thing went into an alley, and there was always shit going on in that alley. The alley of so much love a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, before you came to town, it had the original stairway, and it was cast iron, and the steps were solid, and there was a... it went down the back of the building and the front of the building.
Oh, wow.
And it came up to, there were 2 doorways upstairs. going into the building, one by the kitchen and one by the living room. And in the winter, that was ice. And you just might as well have get in a toboggan and go down the stairs. And fortunately, some drunk driver hit it, the balcony, and knocked it off its pedestal. And so I got a brand new balcony, and I used Subway grate, the metal that crisscross, and so the snow could fall through, and they had kind of like cleats on the top of the metal. It's nothing you go up and down barefoot, but boy, in the wintertime, it was a lifesaver.
So how did you, was there an internal staircase that you could get up and down?
Oh, no.
So how did you get out once the drunk driver sideswiped your staircase?
Well, we had to go down the back one, back part of the stairway for about a week until until they replaced it. It might have been 2 weeks. But they did have insurance, and I got a whole new balcony and stairway with the stairs just going down to the front, my balcony going all the way to the end of the building, so I could put a grill out there, and it was deluxe for me. I thought it was deluxe.
What's the craziest thing? Because Kim always had crazy stories about the alley and people doing crazy stuff because, you know, people banging on those stairs, like – it's like feels like it's happening right next to you because it, you know, because it's bolted to the building and the metal conducts sound and noise like no other. What was the craziest thing that you were alerted to because of that metal staircase in the alley?
Okay, it's a little story. My mother was staying. I had this beautiful leather couch, and it was like 7 feet long, and she loved it. And she was staying for a week. And it was a Saturday night after a football game. And Beth and I had just gone to bed. Mom was in bed. And I heard somebody, three guys running up the stairs. And then running all the way to the end by our bedroom. And so I jumped out of bed and threw my bathrobe on. And went to the door and opened up the door, and there were these three guys pinned against the wall. And I said, "What the F are you doing up here? Get out of here." And they started swearing at me. They were drunk. "Fuck you. Go to hell. Yeah, shove it." Well, I had a friend who was a set designer and costumer in Hollywood in the movies that I had met in Port Townsend. And he gave me one of the original spear that the natives carried in Ramar of the Jungle. It's an old TV series that was probably before you were born, or I'm sure you remember it. But it was sharp. It had a point on it, and it was about 6 feet tall, and it weighed a good 5 pounds. And how they carried them around, I have no idea, but that was it. And for some reason, I lugged it around. And that was my only weapon that I had in my apartment. No guns or anything. And so I opened the door, and they're running by me. And one guy kicked the door and broke the glass. And I'm barefoot in my bathrobe, and they're running down the stair. And so I opened the door, grabbed my spear, the last guy's looking over his shoulder. I cocked my arm. I would have barbecued him. I would have skewered him for sure. So I pumped once, and then I'm thinking to myself, "No, you're going to get in trouble. So I'll just try and trip him up, and then I'll run down and get him." And so I pumped, and then I threw it, and it hit the stairway. And the steel tip bent, and it went in front of him, and he fell and tripped and fell on his face about a third of the way, or two-thirds of the way down the stairway.
You threw the spear at him?
What?
You threw the spear at him?
Yes, you're goddamn right. I was pissed. You know me. I get hot. And I'm running down.
Was alcohol? The after, was there any alcohol?
And my bathrobe opens up, and I'm naked underneath. So, I'm naked, this bathrobe streaming behind me, and I'm buck naked running down after this guy. And this couple, these two guys lived across the street, and they're watching this whole thing go down. And so they all got stumbled up, and my waiters come flying out of the restaurant. My one guy, an ex-Marie, by the way, tackles this one guy. We get him. The other two run away. The cops show up. They track him down. They get them all. And I'm standing there, and he says, "You better cover up, Kim." And I look down. Oh, God, I'm naked. And like I never give a damn. So I close my bathrobe. And then the next day, these guys come out of their building, and I'm going downstairs to bake the bread, and they're teaching at the university, and they said, "Oh, thanks for the show last night, Kim." They were a gay couple, and they loved it. It was quite a show. And I said, "Oh, you're welcome," but we got our guys, and then they had to pay for the door, and I put a new screen door on it, and that was that. Yeah, but that's the most rowdiest.
There's always something going on, like near the balcony, and it was funny.
Yeah,
it
was.
All right, let's talk a little food.
Yeah, baby.
I got another email. Hey Mac, when is Kim going to find out the details of the way that Ruth Chris cooks their steaks? I've been waiting for that. When exactly is the class?
The class is when we get our oven put in, installed, okay. Right. Which will be about 3 months. But we will actually, Matt, who is going to be the general manager, was in Minneapolis last weekend, so I can tell you how they do it. There's a flat top, like you cook hamburgers on. Right. And they sear the steak on both sides, and then they open up this drawer, and it's got grates on it, and then the heat comes from the top, from the infrared burners that get up to 1500 degrees, and then you throw your steak in, and you shove the door shut, and you have big long tongs to turn the steak because you're not putting any part of your body under that heat.
Right.
And a few minutes, you pull it out, flip it over, shove it back in. And then they pull it back to the end of this grate where it's a little cooler. And so it rests there before they plate it. But it's all seared on top and the bottom because they flip it once.
Right.
And that's how they cook them.
So it starts in the middle. It starts on a flat metal surface, sear, and then what we would say is put it on indirect heat. They put it on the blowtorch, and then they flip it again and give it its markings and cook it that way. And then for X number of
and
minutes,
pull it. Yes,
for X number X number of minutes aside. Let me just tell you. Those steaks are hot when they get to you. Just so
they're smoking hot, and the plate is hot too.
Right, it cools down from like I don't know how many degrees, which is interesting. How long does all that take?
It takes maybe total 5 minutes, wow. 5 to 8 minutes, depending on the thickness of your steak.
So you can't be like me, like messing around on your phone and not be paying attention, or you're going to have cinder.
No. Unless you want a hockey puck.
You have cinder blocks, right? With salt, yeah. With salt and some A1.
And all they do, all they put on, everybody has their own seasoning or rub for steaks.
Right.
All they put on the steaks is kosher salt. And they put it on. And let it sit on the counter, pull it out of their steak drawer, put it on a plate, salted on both sides liberally with kosher salt, and that's all they use.
That's it?
That's it. Yeah. Some places have different steak seasonings that they put on their steaks before they cook them. But all I've researched and learned, and from what I understand, from what Matt was told, just salt them. No pepper, no special secret dust, as they call it.
No Kentucky Fried Chicken, 11 herbs and spices, just
You want to taste the steak. That's what they all say back to you. Well, you want to taste the steak, don't you?
Hello. I'll tell you what, and especially when you go to a place like that, right, that's their specialty.
Yes.
Right?
You're
going to pay some money for their steak, and it's going to be good meat.
It's going to be great meat.
Right.
And we have a source that's going to be real good meat.
Oh, really?
It's from Nebraska, Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, and a little bit of Southwest Minnesota, and they're Hereford cows, and they're raised to a certain weight, all the same size. So when they cut their steaks, it's all even similar size. So
really?
When you want a piece of prime rib,
yeah.
If you want the petite cut, which will be about 8 ounces, up to the Bubba cut, which will be about 16 to 24 ounces, depending on your hunger, that's it. But they'll all be the similar size. And, some steers will get to be maybe 2 years old before, 3 years old before they're slaughtered. These are grass fed and then taken to the house. But they're all the same size. I'm very excited. I've tasted some of the steaks, not cooked the way we're going to cook them yet.
Where did you get when you owned your joint? When you owned Sanders, where did you get your steak?
Well, when I was buying prime ribs, right. and fillets, tenderloins, there was a company in North Dakota and South Dakota, North Dakota beef or something like that, that raised steaks. Grass fed them the same way, and they were very, very high grade, not quite prime, but the choice kind of trickles into prime, and that's where those were the steaks, the prime ribs and tenderloins I got. And it was local North Dakota, South Dakota beef. That's how I rolled. I got them through a food company that's nationwide, but I hunted out the steak, and I said, look, put them on your list and make it an exclusive for me. And they did.
Wow.
And so that's how I rolled
But I
don't know what my people are doing now.
Right.
My former,
because that industry has changed a lot,
yes.
the overnight delivery and some of the stuff that you did with seafood, which is have it flown in, and if you want to have great seafood, you had your stuff, bought stuff that was flown in. Now, I mean, people are doing that. I mean, you see Omaha Steakhouse and some other. What's the one you use?
Yeah.
I want to say New Jersey, or
Pat LaFrieda.
Pat LaFrieda.
Right. That's very, very expensive. I'm sure it'd be a lot cheaper. That's all prime. And they overnight ship. I'm going to look up and find out what their commercial rates are.
But that business has matured since you got out of that business. Yeah, I mean, because I remember you first talking to me when you first started ordering stuff, and you were like, "Mac, holy smokes, man, this stuff is beautiful." You know, I hate to even eat it; it's so beautiful, but I will.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I know how much it costs. Like I on a just a regular guy called in and I ordered they porterhouses come in two packs. You got to get two of them. And it was for two of them, I think we talked about it was like $144 or something like that.
For two steaks
Yeah,
or p
two
prime rib?
36 ounce
Oh,
porterhouses.
that's a big steak.
So that's yeah, that's expensive steak. 2 inch cut, and just enough for Beth and I. And of course me, I'll gnaw on the bone for a day too. I can take my boning knife out and scrape that meat off the bone. And make a sandwich on the next day out of it. Oh yeah, I use every ounce of it. And good steak, man, you can't beat it. You cannot beat it. It's real good.
Wow. Well, no, you know what? And especially when you take great steak and then somebody knows how to cook it, right? And that stuff is just, it's delicious. It's delicious. In fact, I got a gift certificate for a place called The Butchery, down in Newport Beach that Kim's taught me some things, right? And one of the things he's taught me is that, if you want to eat a great steak, you got to pay for it, right? So
Yeah.
if you go to your butcher, your supermarket, and you buy what's already wrapped and out, you're going to get what you pay for, right? But it's not going to be a great steak. And so if you're going to eat great steak, you got to pay for it. Now that a lot of people may know that, but when you raise four kids and your sons, are teenagers and they eat everything in the house, right? I mean,
Yeah.
it's like, yeah, we're not buying steak like that, okay? And
No.
then you learn about it and you're like, wow, that would be interesting to do someday. Here's an email for you. Mac, please ask Kim his opinion on Le Creuset cookware. My wife gave me a Christmas gift of a beautiful skillet and a deep saute pan with a lid. I love them.
La Crusette
La
is
Creuset.
absolutely the best cooking equipment you can purchase, and they have knockoffs of Le Creuset or La Creuset.
Le Creuset. You're right.
But the thing is, what it is, it's cast iron, like your normal cast iron skillet that I bake my cornbread in. But what that is, it's coated with an enamel, and it started in France, and you'll see that equipment in all the kitchens all over. And you're a very blessed man to get those two pieces of equipment. And your wife probably paid for the two pieces, unless she got them on sale at TJ Maxx or something. She paid probably $300 to $400 for two pieces of cooking equipment.
Wow.
So,
That's love.
be very happy
That's
and
love, man.
use them.
That's love, right?
That's major beaucoup love.
Beaucoup.
And
Beaucoup.
beaucoup amour. Let me re say it in French. Beaucoup amour. Also, don't leave it on the, don't burn it and mistreat them. You soak it in soapy water and it'll clean up beautifully. And one's probably a Dutch oven, and one's a skillet. And I have about four pieces of Le Creuset. I just I think I gave a couple pieces away to my
Now,
brother
let me
when he
ask you,
was here this summer.
is it colored cast iron that I'm looking at in some of these pictures?
Yeah. Oh God, they've got rainbow of colors. match it up with your kitchen, and I'll bet his wife did with the color with their kitchen. But
I didn't know. I thought cast iron was cast iron. I thought it was just like gray.
Well, cast iron is cast iron, but when you coat it with enamel, you can make it any color you want. Now, the traditional one is kind of like a reddish orange. Right. That's the one that's most dominant. And I have a big Dutch oven like that. But I have a rectangular kind of like lasagna pan with a lid that's La Crusette. And we use that all the time. And then we have a frying pan. And then I have one La Crusette that has like grill marks in the bottom, yes. Like, you know, little lines that are raised that I can do steaks on.
Yes.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Is that really what that's for?
Yeah, well, that's what I use it for. I do fish. I do steaks. But if you want one piece, Mac, if you want to go out, you go to TJ Maxx, you look for La Crusette, and you look for the 7 to 12 quart or the largest size Dutch oven. It's oval with a lid that you can find. And then you can do stews. You can do chicken and dumpling in there. You can do all kinds of great
things,
roasts and whatnot. I used to do
people don't cook like that anymore. People don't cook like that anymore, Kim. You know what I mean? Like
I
mean
know,
that you're, what you're describing.
You make it...
What you're describing to me is my mom, right? I mean, she would do pot roast, right? Which is my God, my mom's pot roast gravy with carrots in it to die for. My kids loved that, right? And it wasn't either an expensive meal or a complicated meal, right?
No.
It was throw that thing in the Dutch oven, right, and let it slow cook, and oh my God, the gravy on the mashed potatoes. I know. It's just it's awesome. And so
but
people don't cook like
anymore. That's the thing about La Crusette, Mac. Now everybody uses a crock pot. But if you want to do something really special, I do lamb shanks in there. Do ossobuco. That's the shank that's
ossobuco.
Cut in.
I've never heard of it.
Ossobucco. Ossobuco. It's an Italian name. And you take beef shanks, and they're cut about 3 inches high, and the meat's on the outside, and you brown them in the Dutch oven, and then you pull them out, sit them on a plate, and then you throw some red wine in there and deglaze the pan so you get all the bits and pieces up from the bottom. Then you put the vegetables, carrots, onions, potatoes, celery if you want, and you put them in back all in there, some garlic, and you get those cooking, and then you put the oxtails back in, or the not oxtails, the shanks, lamb or veal or beef, and you put them in and put the lid on, put it in the oven at about 250, 275, maybe even 3 1/4, no higher than that, and go away for 2 or 3 hours and come back, and you're in the front row.
Yeah.
And the flour that you've dusted your shanks in will thicken the juices and the wine, and the wine will reduce down and leave the flavor and not the alcohol. And it's so good. Yeah. That's what I recommend.
text message here. My mouth is watering, dear Lord! Exclamation mark times three. The but I mean that is that's the way my mom cooked, you know. And I mean she made stew, and it wasn't, again, it was carrots, potatoes, onions, and I don't know what kind of, it wasn't expensive beef, but she'd slow cook that thing all day, and you know she'd throw a little flour in, a little salt and pepper, thicken the gravy, yep. And that was dinner on stew and mashed potatoes. And sometimes she put the potatoes in it, and then it wasn't even stew. It wasn't even mashed potatoes. It was just ladle it onto your plate. And but again, people don't cook like that anymore. I mean, you know, now, right? They crock pot everything, right? But I don't know if it's the same, because most of the time it's, you know, chicken breast in there, you know, and they make a gravy, but it's not like my mom's stew or my mom's pot roast and that which was done in a Dutch oven. At least anyway, that's my take. I just don't see that many people saying that now.
Well, I think they are starting to do that now, Mac.
Really?
And the thing is, the whole point of doing that, shanks. If you get the butcher to cut you 3-inch pieces of shank, whether it's beef or pork or ham shank, whatever they want, it's inexpensive meat. You can take a pot roast that's $2, $3, $4 a pound, a big, huge chunk of meat that's 2 inches thick, weighs maybe 3 or 4 pounds. You brown that off in your Dutch oven, you pull it out, you deglaze the pan, throw your stuff in, throw your pot roast on top of it, or you can do beef tips. You can buy those at the store, even if it's packaged. They're tough. You can't eat those, just saute them up. They're a little chewy. But if you cook them in a Dutch oven like that and cook it for 2-3 hours, you've got some serious eating.
Right.
Delicious. Well, you know what? Tender.
One of the things that Kim, one of the things I love that we do on the show is we'll talk about the history of a dish. And I remember a few years ago, Kim, I don't even know what brought it up. I don't know if I was doing Today in History or something. And it was something about the birth of the Caesar salad.
Yes.
And Kim went off about a power outage in Tijuana.
Yep, that's where it started.
And he tells a story like about ingredient spoiling. But, you know, one of the things that I've learned as we do like culinary history, which is not really the way we do it, it's food history, right? Much for the common man. But, I mean, most, you know, a lot of great dishes that we love started out as the scraps that, you know, middle class and poor people would buy, and then they would, you know, they would do all these tricks with them as women, you know, tried to feed their family on a budget, right? As families tried to feed their, you know, and things like menudo and, you know, and all kinds of other dishes are things that were thrown away.
Yeah.
And that were turned into, you know, great tasting dishes. And, you know, and again, why the utility of the Dutch oven? As Kim said, you could buy cheap beef and turn it into a great meal that would serve. And again, when I was a kid, we had 4 kids, and that was a small family.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, why don't we have like 6 kids like other people do? And then you had to feed them on a middle class income. And so the crock pot wasn't invented yet, and so the Dutch oven was, you know, something that you saw in everybody's kitchen.
Absolutely, and to this day, I still use mine. Beth still uses hers from her mama. Well, not the same piece of equipment because we got La Crusette, but the thing is, we had 4 kids, and we were a middle-class family, and that's how Mom bought stuff. And her mother taught her how to do it. She was one of 4 kids. And you buy cheap cuts of meat, and you cook them all day. And that's it. That's how you do it. I mean, you don't have to be some hotshot chef to turn out great food.
You know, I think it's a higher art form. I mean, because honestly, right? When you have all the big time ingredients and all that, I mean, if you screw, if you fuck that up, then, you know, you're a dope, right? I think the harder thing to do, the more artistic thing to do, is what, like, my mom used to do, smoking in Parliament and drinking Gallo Bin Rosé with a twist-off bottle, right? Right?
Yeah.
Which was make great food for, you know, seven or eight people every night and not spend a shitload of money. That's a little bit more difficult. And I'll just tell you, what, you know, somebody sent me an email. Mac, what were the things your mom used to make? Let me tell you. My mom would make pot roast. My mom would make stew. On Fridays, we would have either fish sticks, if she wasn't feeling like cooking, which she always did, right? Or we would have cream tuna, right? Cream tuna is delicious, right? It is. You read the recipe for cream tuna, it is nothing, right? It's boiled peas, dump them in, right? Tuna fish, right? Flour and milk and whatever, salt and pepper, blah, 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 thicken it up.
Cream of mushroom soup sometimes.
Right? And then that ladled over a piece of toast, right?
That's it.
That was cream tuna.
That's it.
But let me just tell you, I would eat it this second because Kathleen could rock that shit. We would have goulash, right? Which is hamburger noodles, whole stewed tomatoes, onions, right?
Yes.
Everything.
Hello.
Right? We would have goulash. She made pork chops that are to die for, and they were half condensed milk, half cream of mushroom soup, lightly brown the pork chops, and let them simmer for 90 minutes. That was it, right? And so she had
–
yeah, and she – and the gravy that goes with the pork chops over mashed potatoes is the best. Right? It's the best.
Absolutely.
And she started making sandwiches that she created.
Yes.
That my friends would like, they would leave like anything they were doing to come over to our house and eat. But they started out on French bread. And then she learned to, you know, hollow out the French bread so there wasn't, so it wasn't so bready, right? And it was ground beef, I think Worcestershire sauce, onions, green onions, and she put something else in there. I don't know what it was. And she took that concoction, and then she would ladle it in the bread and with a slice of American cheese over it. And she'd put this long thing. She'd put this long thing in the oven and cook it, and then she'd cut slices of it. And then later on, she evolved it to smaller buns, individually wrapped, and she'd put those. My friends would devour that shit. And she would do that, and she would make homemade French fries, which is like quarter a potato long ways, right?
Yeah.
And she would dump those in oil, and, I mean, big French fries, not little ones. And my friends would just sit there, and they would do that. But those are the kind of meals that I ate, you know, growing up, and a lot
we
of
both
it,
did.
Right? A lot of it centered around, you know, the Dutch oven. And so, amazing.
Yep.
That's what I cook. What I mean, when you look back, Kim, and the stuff that you ate growing up, what were the staples of your home? I just listed mine. What were yours?
A lot of chicken, roasted chicken, baked chicken. Chicken cooked in the Dutch oven, and then she'd make. Then she'd do mashed potatoes and peas, and then we'd do a roast beef. She would cook in the Dutch oven, and then we'd have it with mashed potatoes and peas for Sunday dinner, 2 o'clock. Every Sunday was our main dinner. And then, you know, a lot of times we'd have she'd even do fried chicken. She made mean fried chicken. And
my mom wasn't, she didn't do fried chicken. She baked her chicken, and it was Rice Krispie chicken. It was melted, you know, melt some butter on the stove, roll the chicken through it. You, with the rolling pin, You rolled Rice Krispies.
That's right.
You rolled Rice Krispies. You didn't turn it into a dust, though. You left enough of the Rice Krispie in there so it would have a little crunch, right, in addition to enough dust. You rolled it through that. Garlic, Lowry's garlic seasoning with parsley, right?
Yes,
and then a little salt and pepper. Put that in the oven for 350 degrees for 30 minutes and unbelievable chicken. But that's the chicken that I ate, and I ate it growing up. It was back in the day when you ate chicken with skin on it.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. You loved it. I loved the skin.
I'd pull the chin off the skin of her chicken, and I'd eat the rest of the chicken because I was hungry. But the skin was the best. Now kids look at you like, chicken with skin on it? You're like, yeah, just shut up. You don't even know what you're missing.
Yeah, that's the, and we ate a lot of chip beef, you know, shit on a shingle kind of stuff that it was called.
Hey, what would my mom have made beef stroganoff with? What kind of beef? Because that was a little bit chewy, right?
That'd be stew meat. You go, you know, you get stew meat, and the key, that's what I was saying earlier. You can go buy stew meat. It's just you got to cook it a little longer. You simmer it like you do your pork chops in the same gravy. And then you add mushrooms. And then you cook up the noodles that are wide noodles, maybe half an inch and a couple inches long. And then pour it over the noodles. And you just before you serve it, you add a little sour cream.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember seeing
to the gravy, and that's what makes it the stroganoff. And for me, that was my favorite.
Oh, really?
Oh God, I could eat a gallon of it. it was just the best, and easy to make.
Yeah.
And
that's what I didn't know that at the time, but the thing I've come to admire about my mom's cooking, you know, now that I cook more, is how great the food tastes. And this goes back to what initially spawned the conversation, how great the food is, how it's not difficult to cook, and the ingredients tend to be pretty inexpensive because you were feeding somewhere between, you know, most families.
Six
and 10 people and there was an art to that. Somebody just sent me a text. Mac, did you grow up eating steak? No, I didn't.
My kids, I didn't either.
Yeah. I mean, if we grilled 90% of the time, it was hamburgers and hot dogs. That's what got teed up. You know, it wasn't till late in Kathleen's career that we had, you know, barbecue chicken, and she found a Lowry's sweet and sour sauce that, oh my God, was to die for. And I don't even think they make it anymore, but it was absolutely delicious on fried chicken. And but we did not.
We ate roast. Now mom would buy it seemed like about. It looked like 10-pound chuck steak to me. You know, lots of fat, maybe a little bone in there. It was probably around 4 or 5 pounds. And then she would cook that. But that's as close to steak that I ever got as a kid growing up. And when I was living in California and finished high school when I was on my own, I would take that chuck steak and then I would marinate it with wine, seasoning, garlic, and I'd put it in a little Pyrex glass dish and soak it for at least 24 hours and flip it 2 or 3 or 4 times during the day, and the next day I would grill it outside on my little Weber. And that was the first hit of steak for me, and I thought I was hot shitting in the front row. And the only reason it was worth the shit was that I marinated the hell out of it. I had olive oil on there, I didn't know olive oil back then in California, you know, 1960.
We talked about my mom's flank steak recipe, right? And that is quintessentially what we're talking about here. In that flank steak, right? Stand by to have a head. You know those headaches you get when you chew too much on the side of your head because your muscles are like, yeah,
your jaw is just exhausted.
That's flank steak, you know? Right? But I mean, when you marinate it overnight in the great marinade my mom has, and then you throw it on the grill, and she always sliced it diagonally. You do that.
Yep.
Oh my God, it is to die for. But that's, you know, again, that's what spawned this whole conversation, is, you know, just the, you know, the cast iron, you know, the Dutch oven, and how really, when you think about it, the Dutch oven enabled women to prepare big meals for big families economically, and that was a requirement in middle class America. And it's just kind of interesting. And now, you know, kids grow up eating steak. They grow up eating out. I mean, how often did you go out to eat as a kid?
Oh, I didn't. I didn't. I think it was Frisch's Big Boys where we went out. And I get a today's version of the Big Mac and fries and a Coke and then strawberry pie. And that was it, man. I was high on the hog.
Big time.
One thing I wanted to say about buying the inexpensive, like the flank steak and you marinate the steak. When you cut it across the grain. You know, you look at the steak and you see which way the lines are, the grain's running on the meat, and you cut across that way, and you can cut it at a dais like your mama did, and that makes it easy to eat. It's less time chewing and more time enjoying the flavor of something. But the art form is, don't be afraid to invent your own marinade. You know, Worcestershire sauce, lemon juice breaks things down. And overnight, 24 hours, and then grill it. And then also don't overcook it. Medium rare at most done. And you have something really fine and not too expensive.
Yeah, no, I'm telling you. I've grown up, and then my ex-wife Susan, we'd be at my mom's house for a while, and for a week or so visiting, and then after we have the kids, we'd come out and visit.
Yeah.
You know, it was like this food holiday. You know, and then when Kathleen decided to like really tee it up, you know, for Thanksgiving, I mean, the Thanksgiving meal I still eat today is my mother's Thanksgiving recipe. My mom, you know, did crown roast pork.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God, you should have seen that shit. She would have dressing in the center of that crown roast.
Yep. I was just gonna say yep.
Oh my God, and she would. I mean, my ex-wife, she took all my mom's recipes. So I've eaten my mom's food since I was a little kid. And I still eat it, you know, just about every week, whether it's pork chops or chicken. Like I said, one of the things that I marvel at, though, is how easy the recipes are, how inexpensive they are, but how great they taste. And again, that's kind of the hallmark of the Dutch oven and that period when, you know, moms were stayed at home and families were bigger and you had to you wanted to deliver that kind of food on a budget, which is pretty cool. Pretty cool.
And like the pork crowned roast, you can order a crown roast at your butcher shop and have him trim it up and tie it for you in a circle. And then you can roast it off in the oven. And then halfway through, you put your stuffing in the center. You don't pack it down tight, but you put your stuffing in the center and finish it off. And you get it out and you cut the string. And then you can cut, everybody gets a pork chop and you get some stuffing. It's to die for. And if you don't want to do that, you just buy the roast like a prime rib, a bone-in prime rib of pork, and cook it just like we cook our prime rib in the Sanders book or our recipe, and make sure your pork is about 150, and it'll come out to be a 160 when it's finished resting, and it'll be kind of wee pink inside, and we don't have trichinosis anymore today, folks. Okay, that's what was happening when Mac and I were growing up, but you don't have that shit anymore. So if it's your pork is a little pink, it just means it's juicy and deluxe.
Oh, nobody's gonna nobody's gonna die?
No. Now if it's red and raw, you're still not gonna die, but it's gonna be chewy.
Right. But that's nothing, because you still hear people say that. You know, oh, the pork's pink.
Of course you do.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, that pork is good. Prime rib of pork. We're gonna do it at Hal's new restaurant called Harry's.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're gonna have a pork porterhouse. Bone in porterhouse of pork. Hello, baby. It's gonna be about 2 inches thick and weigh about over a pound.
Whoa.
This is a serious steakhouse I'm involved in.
Serious food, man. No, but again, I look back. I mean, and like I said, I've eaten that food almost my whole life. My mom's stuff. And some of her dishes, though, are a little bit more complicated, like beef stroganoff, But she served that over rice with a vegetable.
Yep.
Right. But again, Friday, we were Catholic, so we ate fish on Friday. And it was most of the time she was not going out and buying salmon for everybody. That was for sure. We were eating. I think we ate Swanson's fish sticks. She didn't even go Mrs. Paul on our ass. You know, we went fish sticks with French fries, and she'd put them she'd bake them in the oven. Boom. And that was dinner. Or we'd do cream tuna. And
I am laughing my ass off because that's what I ate. Honest to God, fish sticks and those crinkle French fries frozen that my mom would put on a tray and bake them off and open a jar of tartar sauce.
Right. We had
and
ketchup.
I thought I'd die and go on Fridays.
Yeah, we didn't.
I'd die and go on to heaven.
We didn't have
then on Wednesday was bowling night for them.
All right.
And during the bowling season, which is the wintertime, and we would have Swanson TV dinners.
You know what?
That was it.
But you know what? Again, how fired up when your mom would ask you, like, well, we're going to go bowling again. What kind of TV dinner you want, Kim? And she would let you, like, I used to, this was my go-to. My go-to was Swanson's, right? Fried chicken with corn and mashed potatoes, and they had like a little apple dumpling or strudel or some shit.
Tart thing. Not tart, but
something.
Looked like the inside of an apple pie.
Right, exactly. Right there. And you had to pull the foil off that at some point to crisp it up at the end.
There's a little line, and you turn the foil at one corner of it so it let the steam out, and then at the end you take the whole thing off to crisp up the fried chicken. That's how that worked. And my favorite was the turkey, because it was more food. It had, not only did it have turkey and gravy and mashed potatoes,
right,
and stuffing and corn, the mixed vegetable thing. It had a little cranberry compote in that extra little square in the front. Oh, God, I was in heaven. Yeah.
And then, let me tell you, one of the things that we were, when we would have TV dinners, right? One of the things that my mom allowed us to do was bust out the TV trays and eat and eat dinner while you were watching TV. Because in the world that Kim and I grew up in, right, there was structure to that shit, man. There were, I mean, you came to dinner, right? You washed your hands, and if you were dirty as shit, which some of us tended to be, you know, you changed your clothes. And that's how you came to dinner. You didn't, like, roll into dinner like a piece of shit, right? Everybody got there, you said grace, right? And then afterwards, you cleared cleared the table, right? And my mom, when we were little kids, I mean, she did the dishes. And then as we got older, right, we would help out every night. Every night. So when we got to, like, fucking eat on a TV tray, right, in front of, when it happened, the color fucking TV, boo! Yeah. And God forbid somebody should knock over a TV tray and shit go everywhere on Kathleen's shag carpet. Then it was like,
oh God.
Yeah, now we're going to be sentenced to the kitchen for another 6 years.
If we weren't home at 6 o'clock, you didn't eat.
Really?
And you had to, we were there at 6 o'clock, it was dinner bell. Dad had a couple of beers. Mom had her martini and her apron on and her sundress or whatever in the hell it was she cooked in. And you'd sit down to dinner, say grace, and then we'd go around the table. And what did you do today, Kim?
Really?
What did you do today, Jenna? And you have a discussion. And that's how the structure was. And that's what's gone today. The families don't do that.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
everybody's
that's...
and I couldn't imagine growing up today and iPads and phones and TVs going while dinner's being eaten.
It just
grosses me out.
Well, let me just tell you, you know, in the speaking I do around the country, there's a price to pay for that. And that is kids that don't grow up with the infrastructure that they need. Right.
Yep.
When life rolls on them, and I'll tell you, the suicide problem in the country is not a mental health issue. It's young people cannot cope with life when life boots them in the fucking face because they just haven't been allowed to do that, and they don't have the infrastructure, you know, anymore that we had, you know, coming to dinner. Let me just tell you. You just said if you weren't at dinner, you didn't eat. Let me just tell you.
That's right.
With corporal punishment, Kathleen. I never missed dinner in my fucking life. Let me tell you what I used to have to do.
I know I didn't.
What I would have, my cousin Tom, who turned 60 yesterday, his wife, Julie, took him to New York City, right? Now, Tom would never go to New York City when there's no baseball being played, and he's never been there in his life. But Julie, his wife, says she wants to go, right? So they got to go to plays and shit like that. I said, so she wanted to go, get you the ticket. You can't say no because it's your 60th birthday. And so now you're going to plays and museums and shit. He said, exactly. I'm like, unbelievable. But anyway, I would give Tom a ride home in my 1953 Ford Mainline. Right, biggest steering, one of the biggest steering wheels ever invented, and so we would go from our high school to Tom's house, you know. And my Uncle Jim is one of the greatest people in my life, right? My Uncle Jim would be home, and he's a great guy, and he'd have me in. And then again, my dad was gone when I was a kid. My dad was gone for 6 months every year, and my Uncle Jim.
Great.
Always was there for me. I'd come in and, you know, he'd talk to us and then he'd look at me, goes, you're staying for dinner. And I said, I can't, I haven't called my mom. He goes, you're staying for dinner. Millie, set my Aunt Millie, Mildred Petrolli. She was the Italian in the family, right?
Oh, lucky right. You.
So Mildred. And so I would eat because I loved being at that house, right? So I would eat.
Yeah.
But I hadn't told Kathleen. I didn't ask. I didn't tell her. And then I would go home, and Kathleen would have made whatever she made. So what do you think I did? You think I said, I can't
eat again?
Exactly.
I'm no dummy.
Exactly. I would eat a second full dinner. Because let me tell you, I wasn't man enough, right, to bow up on Kathleen and say, yeah, I already ate. Like, not only no, but fuck no. I would never say that to her. And so I would eat a second time, man. I'd roll into my bedroom and collapse, like, oh my God, I'm gushing food out of my ears. Because let me tell you, and let me tell you about Kathleen. Like, if I didn't eat, if I didn't eat what I normally ate, she would look at me and say, "Did you eat someplace before you came home?" And what would I do naturally? I'd lie to her, right? No, I didn't. I just don't feel good, right? I'm not going to tell her the truth. And so, anyway, yeah, funny, funny shit. All right, who do you like in the Super Bowl?
Oh, I think if I was a betting man,
yeah, if you were,
I would, which I am, I'd probably take San Francisco.
You would? That surprises me.
Yeah, yes, I would. I have some feeling.
Oh, really?
That the Niners are going to – Shanahan is having a great year coaching. I think he might even outfox the old fox.
Oh, really?
But probably the money will be on Kansas City. And when I call Disco, since he's from the Bay Area, I'm going to have to take Kansas City. So I'll bet a few hundred on Kansas City, but I'm hoping the 49ers win because, you know, we've had this. I've told you I used to go to 49er games in Keysar.
Right. No, I so did I.
And I would we'd sit in the end zone and we'd you could take beer into Keysar, and the tickets were $3.50 to go to Keysar to watch a football game. We go to the Buena Vista, drink Irish coffees before, and then grab a case of Meyer beer for $5, go sit in the end zone. And if Brody had a good game, the locker rooms were in a house outside the stadium. You remember that?
Yeah.
And so they'd have to walk through this tunnel right where we were sitting. If he had a bad game, he'd put his helmet on, and all the guys would walk away from him, put their helmets on, and they'd let him start running. And there'd be a shower of empty beer cans coming down on him. And my friend Tom Grevin used to date Katie Brody, his sister, younger sister. And yeah, that was fun.
Back in the day.
Keysar was great. So I was a 49er fan when I lived in the Bay Area. I loved them. Right. Loved going to watch them play. My uncle was a reporter for AP at the time. And got to sit up in the press box once in a while.
Wow.
And actually, I was down in the locker room for the East-West Shrine game in Keysar.
The Shrine game was one of the, you know, was one of the premier all-star games, you know.
That was back
in the day. And you know, that, and I want to say the Senior Bowl in Mobile, Alabama. And do they even play the Shrine Bowl anymore?
I don't think so. I don't know. I just don't know. But I know I sure got to go down to the locker room. It was pretty cool with my uncle he was asking questions.
The East-West Shrine Bowl is a postseason college football all-star game that is played annually since 1925 through January 1919. It was known as the East-West Shrine Game. Now it is known as the... That's cool because, you know, St. Jude's has a huge presence. It was played on Saturday, January 18th, 2020. So it was played
last... Change a good thing.
Yeah, it was played last Saturday. And let me tell you, if you've never been around the Shriners and seen what they've done, they do. What a great, great organization. The families they help. You see those...
You see those
kids on those commercials. And I remember
I love it.
I got
very emotional.
Oh my God. I got involved with the Shriners up in North Dakota because a friend of Kim and mine by the name of Mike Berg, who's a football coach, he says, would you ever want to like help us out and would do some broadcasting? I said, look, whatever you guys do, I'll come be a part of. He said, well, I said, no, I'll bring my show. It's not going to cost you anything. You just tell me and I'll be there. And they're like, are you serious? I'm like, if my mom knew that I could help you and I didn't help you, she would beat my ass, okay? Of course I'll help you. And so I talked about, you know, so normally they would put shit in the paper and you know, they do cleft palate. And what else do they do, Kim? They do a series of surgeries that they kind of specialize, yeah, that St. Jude's, you know, specializes. And if they could help you, they pay for everything. You know, the parents' lodging down in wherever you go to. For us, living up where Kim and I lived, up in North Dakota, it was down to the Twin Cities, right? And
yeah,
they pay for your transportation. They feed you. You know, they pay for you to eat down there. The whole thing. And then they do all this shit for your kid. So so I started talking about this stuff. And I want to say I must have had him in the 3 months leading up. I probably had him on, you know, three or four times.
Yeah.
And so the day of, I go out to this this domed football stadium and where Kim lives, called the Alaris Center. I don't know if it's still called the Alaris Center, but
yeah,
it was.
It is.
And so they're using one of the banquet halls to do screening and interviews and stuff like that to screen people. And so I'm just there doing my show, right, like this. And they're out in front cooking food for the people that came, and there's all kinds of shriners, yeah, stopping by. And they start coming up to me and saying, "This is unbelievable." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And they're like, "Mac, we normally get like maybe six people that will come here. We'll be out here all day, and we might get five or six people." It was noon, and they had had 25, you know, different families show up.
And, wow.
I mean, to the point where these guys are in tears. And then you know, you learn
That's
more
so
about
cool.
you yeah, you learn more about the what they do, and then you talk to the families, you know, who hear about this, who didn't know about it, and you know, they know that the surgeries are so expensive, and then all of a sudden somebody just takes all that off their plate. And it was just you talk about cool on top of cool on top of cool, and then they do, you know, for their marketing, St. Jude's, they'll fly like radio people down. I never went, but other people associated with my radio station went. You know, and they'd come home and they'd tell these stories about, you know, the hallways are really wide there in the hospital so that kids can ride tricycles and bikes down the hallways and pedal their little cars and shit. You know, it's this whole, you know, complex built for kids. And
yes, it is.
And so I've never been. I'd love to go someday, but just cool on top.
Yeah, I would too.
Let me read you a couple of emails. One, Mac, our household of Catholics would eat tuna casserole almost every Friday during Lent. I can't.
Oh, that's right, tuna casserole. I forgot about that one.
I can't.
Yeah.
I can't even see one anymore without vomiting. Yes. Yes, occasional fish sticks, but always that damn tuna casserole. Disgusting. What did you hate? I didn't hate anything my mom cooked. My mom didn't cook, she didn't cook liver or anything that I hated. My mom, yeah, like my mom would yell and I would come running. It didn't because my mom had serious game. Here's another e-woman.
Well,
Mac, you say your mom smoked. What kind of ashtrays did you have in the house? Well, we had mostly glass and an occasional one of those beaded ones. Right, remember those? They'd have like the metal top with the grooves for cigarettes that went across the center of it.
Yeah,
and the big
exactly.
And then it was like upholstery for a chair on the bottom, filled with something, beans or something like that. We had occasional one of those, but mostly glass. Kathleen was a glass ashtray woman. Well, thank you very much for asking.
Oh, that's great.
Here's another one. I swear to gosh, I had a flank steak last night with just pepper, a little garlic salt, and some of F-18 man's barbecue rub, which he got from an El Paso barbecue joint. I slow cooked it about 10 minutes on both sides. It came out very tasty. It's my new go-to. I'm also getting my flu shot now. Also, the Hungry Man TV dinner referenced has an apple dessert. That is all it's called, is apple dessert.
Hungry Man. I remember Hungry Man.
The Hungry Man was like, you know, they had normal TV dinners, and then you had the Hungry Man version, right?
Yeah.
Which was longer, with longer packaging, bigger meal.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah, here's another email. Mac, I'm laughing about the TV tray stuff. It was a big deal.
We did too. TV trays were big. In fact, I had TV trays up until when we lived above the original Sanders. I had a TV tray.
Because let me tell you, you would not think of taking the dinner plate and getting up from the table and going to watch the TV.
No.
That's
no.
Not the way.
Well, unless you were going to take it outside, because you'd never come in into the dining room.
Yeah, unless you were running away and you were just going to eat there before you left the house. I mean, that's not that. No, but I mean, think about that. That's the structure of children are seen and not heard, right? That's the structure that you were not allowed to go into the living room. Like, someday I'm going to go into that motherfucker, and I'm going to jump on the couch, but not while she's still alive. I mean, that was the structure we grew up with, you know, going to church, right? And, and our mom and dad's part of the men's club and the women's club of the church and shit like that. And I'm not sure that wasn't a better existence, though, because I think in a lot of ways it provided the infrastructure that would, you know, life got tough, you know. There was that structure of the family. There was that structure of the community. And now I think in a lot of ways, there's a lot of people that are adrift, and that's not good. That's not good.
So. It's very sad, the family structure today. And nobody eats at home together. And if they do eat at home, there's side stuff going on. You know, they're on their phones or iPads or something.
Yeah.
There's only one thing happening when you sat down at our dinner table, and that was eating your dinner and telling everybody what you did that day,
right,
or if you did anything special. That was it. It was family time.
Right. No, and here's another one. Mac, does your family, when you guys eat together, do you sit together and say grace? Absolutely. We still do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, obviously we don't have all four of them together anymore, but when I cook for Catherine and Colleen, either we'll sit at the kitchen table or we'll sit at the counter in the kitchen and we'll get our food and then we all sit and we say grace together and we sit together and eat. And so, but again, I mean, like, but I mean, there'll be nights when we're, you know, eating something else and we'll grab food and go watch the ball game and stuff like that. We'll do that. I think that structure is important. It's so important for kids, right? That is the structure of your family. And when it's do whatever the fuck you want, that does not prepare them for life. Ultimately, doesn't prepare them for life.
No, it does not. You need family. You need a contact between the parents and the kids.
And the other thing,
it's,
I think,
the natural order of things.
Right, you know what? And people will scoff at that, the natural order of things. But let me just tell you, you know, you can't be anything great in your life if you don't respect other people in your life. And that's part of if you want to be great, in my opinion, you have to learn self-discipline. You have to learn respect. You have to learn hard work, right? And you can't be great if you won't learn those things. And the infrastructure in the family. Now, I make fun of a friend of mine, Napa Man, right? Napa Man, he's from Napa, right? He went to the Naval Academy. He's a big guy.
Yeah.
He sang a cappella. I didn't know that, but I found that out somehow. A little bird told me that. He sang a cappella. You know, with all the facial gestures and all that? So I went by to see him. After I got a haircut about a month or so ago, he lives down in San Clemente. So I got my haircut. I swung by, but he wasn't there. And so, you know, it was about 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. So I figured he was at Mass. But his truck's there. His wife's car's there. So I went up and I knocked on the door. No answer, you know. And so, you know, I was giving him a tough time. I said, so do you, you know, you guys walk to church? And he said, yeah. I'm like, are you guys like the Von Trapp family? Like singing like doo-wop, doo-wop, walking down the street, all dressed alike? He's like, stop it. Don't go there. And I said, no, seriously. But you know what? It is that infrastructure, right? that creates that that creates that stability in life for young people. And it is you looking at them saying, don't ever quit. All right. Don't ever quit, because you will encounter, right, these circumstances in your life again. A boss you don't care for, a supervisor you don't care for, colleagues that you don't care for. And this situation in high school on this team is going to present you with a situation that you are going to face in your life again.
Yep.
Right. And you need to learn to conquer it now. That's why you don't quit. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep.
I thought it was about how unhappy I am and my feelings. Well, look, we care about your feelings, but not very much, okay? You're going to have to learn to put them aside and do the right thing, because other people depend on you, and there's certain things we just don't do, and quitting's one of them.
Ooh. That's so, so.
Yeah.
So true.
Yeah. Anyway. All right, man. Any big plans for the weekend?
Well, yes. I'm going the Sioux, our hockey team, plays in Duluth. Number 2 in the country, number 11 in the country. And they're both games are televised this week. And the first game tonight is 7:30 our time on CBS.
Oh, again?
So you could probably watch that.
I watched the Miami game when they went double overtime shootout.
And then they won
in the shootout. So they're on again.
They're on CBS tonight.
I'll watch it.
So CBS. You should. That's going to be a great game.
And who are they playing?
They're playing Scotty Sandlin, Minnesota Duluth.
Ooh.
They've won the last two national titles.
Yeah, heavyweights.
But they got swept by St. Cloud last weekend. So it's going to be a great game. They're going to be pissed off, and Sue is going to have to bring their A game, or they're going to get spanked.
All right. I'll write that down. I'll write that down and watch it. Well, thank you very much for the visit today. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And it was tremendous. And I'm going to give you a call probably Sunday.
All right.
Talk a little sports and have a few political questions for you.
Oh, shit. Don't even bother me with that shit. All right.
No.
You can. I'm doing nothing. I'm just hanging out this weekend. So give me a call.
Okay, good.
There you have
it. All right, thank you for a great day.
Now, the one and only chef from All Marine Radio, Kim Holmes. So now I said we were gonna do Today in History, and I forgot because I did the Jim Lehrer kind of speech. So let me do Today in History. And then I've had a couple people request that, Matt, could you play that Jim Lehrer audio again? And we will play that going out the door today. So Today in History. Today in History, sponsored by my daughter Catherine, who gave me this this calendar, and this will make her happy if she knows I'm using it. So on January 24th, 1961, U.S. Air Force bomber breaks apart over North Carolina, dropping two atomic bombs. Right? Yeah, you hear that, right? And in your head, you hear, you hear like what? What was that? Yeah, exactly. The record did not skip. A U.S. Air Force B-52 bomber was flying over North Carolina when a failure on the right wing caused the aircraft to fall apart in midair. The aircraft had two atomic bombs on board that eventually hit the earth near Goldsboro, North Carolina. The U.S. National Security Archive released details regarding the incident in 2014, and according to officials, the two weapons were dangerously close to detonating, a matter of just two wires failing to cross and causing nearly 28,000 immediate deaths. the parachute on one of the bombs opened incorrectly, and it landed in the ground without issue. The second bomb's parachute failed to open, and it fell to the ground without any resistance to alleviate the impact. The second bomb was in the armed setting after it fell to Earth, but the impact of the fall incapacitated another feature of the weaponry that was necessary to detonate it. The declassification of the details regarding the incident and many more like it shined a light on the surprising frequency of potentially catastrophic events involving nuclear weapons. Just 2 months after the accidental bombs dropped in Goldsboro, another B-52 crashed near Yuba City, California. Yuba City's like 25 miles outside of Sacramento, maybe a little bit more, right? With two nuclear weapons on board. In that case, safety devices on board prevented accidental detonation. I will tell you, when I was a kid, I might have been 12 years old, and it was during the Vietnam War when an ammunition supply train, right, detonated for about, I don't know how many hours in Sacramento, at one of the rail yards in Sacramento. All that ordnance headed to Vietnam. And I'm out, I'll never forget, I was out in my driveway playing basketball, and you could hear these, right? And you could hear them in the distance, and they didn't sound like anything, and they went on for hours. Let me see if I can find that, when the hell that was. Here it is. Now, this happened in Roseville, which is in north side of Sacramento, right? April 29th, 1973. So I'd have been a sophomore in high school. I'm out in my driveway playing basketball. A five-hour series of devastating explosions ripped through a bomb-laden freight train near Roseville, California, like a slow-motion string of giant firecrackers, causing the evacuation of thousands of residents. Astonishingly, although the blasts were heard as far as 40 miles away and windows were blown out of buildings 5 miles away from the scene, no deaths were reported. How about that? It shows a picture of it, right? Yeah. Anyway, and I'll do the one for tomorrow because I don't do a show tomorrow. January 25th, 1949, Axis Sally stands trial for World War II crimes. On January 25th, 1949, American Mildred Gillers, also known as Axis Sally, she'd been the German equivalent of Tokyo Rose, began her trial for war crimes during World War II. Gillers moved to Germany in 1934 when she began hosting propaganda radio programs. She tallied countless anti-Allied broadcasts, but just one was responsible for her conviction. The radio play Vision of Invasion was aimed at scaring U.S. soldiers away from invading Europe on D-Day. Gillers was sentenced to 10 to 30 years behind bars and a $10,000 fine. Yeah, today in history. I wonder how much time she actually served. What's her name? Mildred Gillers. Hold on, we'll find out. Most of those people did not serve their full terms. Axis Sally. Mildred Elizabeth Gillers, nicknamed Axis Sally, along with Rita Zucca, was an American broadcaster employed by Nazi Germany to disseminate propaganda during World War II. Following her capture in post-war Berlin, she became the first woman to be convicted of treason against the United States. Treason normally is not a good thing to be convicted of. Right? In March 1949, she was sentenced to 10 to 30 years of imprisonment. She was released in 1961. So she served 12 years in prison for her propagandizing. Here's a picture of Mildred Gillers from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. What did she do after the trial? Later life. Having converted to Roman Catholicism while in prison, Gillers went to live at the Our Lady of Bethlehem Convent in Columbus, Ohio, and taught German, French, and music at St. Joseph's Academy in Columbus. In 1973, she returned to Ohio Wesleyan University to complete her degree. She died of colon cancer at Grant Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio, on June 25th, 1988. So, yeah, Mildred Gillers, more than you ever wanted to know, right? See, today in history, already paying dividends. And we'll end the week on a high note. And I struggled to get these words out earlier, but, you know, one of the coolest things about being a United States Marine is the other people who you meet that either are or were United States Marines. And Jim Lehrer is a great example to every journalist on this planet of what it is to be devoted to the truth, to not be afraid of articulate discourse, and respect your adversaries. And the nation sorely, sorely needs that. So I played this in the first hour of the show. It was sent to me by, it's his speech at the dedication of the National Museum of the Marine Corps in November of 2006. And I've got a number of emails and texts saying, hey, who was that? What was it? So let me just read you his time in the Marine Corps and what he did. The because, you know, he went on to a distinguished career as a broadcaster. And so this is Jim Lehrer's. Let's see. And this is his bio at PBS.org. So it's not his Wikipedia page. He was born at Wichita, Kansas in 1934, received an AA degree from Victoria College and a BJ, I believe that is a law degree, from the University of Missouri before joining the Marine Corps. From 1959 to 1966, he was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News and the Dallas Times Herald. He was also a political correspondent for the Times Herald for several years, and in 1968, he became that paper's city editor. Now, what I'm specifically interested in is his time in the Marine Corps. So let me go to the Wikipedia page and see if they have more information on what he did as a Marine. After graduating from college, Lehrer joined the United States Marine Corps and served for 3 years as an infantry officer. That's right. That's where the best of the best serve. Sorry for all you other jackasses out there, but that's where we go. Right? He attributed his service and travels with helping him look past himself and feel a connection to the world that he would not have otherwise experienced. This is footnoted. There was an interview he did, and I'll have to find it. And maybe I'll play it on Monday, if I can find it. But he reflects on his time in the Marine Corps, and it says, it's a PBS page, it says they could not find it. And hopefully that'll be different from this, what you're going to listen to. So him reflecting on his time in the Marine Corps and what it meant to his life. But this is him on, I believe, November 10th, right, which would have been the 231st anniversary of the United States Marine Corps. And this is the day that the National Museum of the Marine Corps was dedicated. And Jim Lehrer, like so many other Marines who participated in that, who made it happen. I mean, when I spoke to General Christmas and I interviewed him, I've interviewed him a few times, but the last time I interviewed him, I asked him, did you think when you conceived it, that the National Museum of the Marine Corps would become what it is? And he said, no. Never in our wildest dreams did we believe it would galvanize the heart, the soul, and the spirituality of the Marine Corps. You know, we knew that it would be a cool place and a good place and someplace that people would come, but we did not know how warmly it would be embraced. So this is to end this week on a high note. This is a Jim Lehrer speaking during the opening of the, I believe he was the MC for the opening of the National Museum of the Marine Corps, those ceremonies in Quantico, right, just out front the entrance of it on November 10th of 2006.
Generals, colonels, majors, captains, lieutenants, warrant officers, sergeants, corporals, privates, ladies and gentlemen. We are the Marines, and in this museum, our story is told. It is a single monumental story made up of 231 years of many separate stories of heroism and courage, of dedication and sacrifice, of service to our country and to our Corps, of honor and loyalty to each other in war and in peace. 231 years of professionalism and pride, of squared corners and squared away lockers, perfect salutes and good haircuts, well-shined shoes and eyes right, 231 years of Semper Fis and DIs. The first time I came to Quantico was 51 years ago. I came as an officer candidate, a PLC, on the train from Washington, having just traveled from Texas on the first airplane ride of my life. On the orders of a drill instructor, a DI, I fell in at attention with 40 other candidates on the platform at the train station over at Quantico, and the DI told us to answer up, "Here, sir," when our name was called. And he got to mine and he said, "Lee here, And like some kind of idiot, I blurted out, "It's pronounced Lara, sir." There was silence, absolute silence. And then I heard the terrifying click, click, click of leather heels on the deck of that train station platform coming in my direction. And suddenly there he was, the DI, right in front of me, his face right up in mine, and I paraphrase and cleanse it up a bit, but he said, "Candidate, if I say your name is Little Bo Peep, your name is Little Bo Peep. Do you hear me?" Oh, I heard him all right. And I think it was at that very moment that I really became a United States Marine. I am still one today, and I will remain one forever, as did my late father, and as is my older and only brother. I came from a family of Marines into the family of Marines. My father served in the 1920s under the great Smedley Butler right here at Quantico. He saw combat in Haiti and came out a corporal. My brother and I were both 1950s Cold War Marines in the 3rd Marine Division in the Far East. Since our Corps was founded on this day in 1775, there have been more than 4 million men and women who have worn the uniform of a United States Marine. This museum is about all of them, including us three Lee Here Errs and even the Little Bo Peeps. That's because this museum is about what it means to be a Marine, no matter the time, the length, place, rank, or nature of the service. It's about the shared experience and the shared knowledge that comes from from being a U.S. Marine, such as knowing that you are only as strong and as safe as the person on your right and on your left, that a well-trained and motivated human being can accomplish almost anything, that being pushed to do your very best is a godsend, that an order is an order, a duty is a duty, that responsibility goes down the chain of command as well as up, as do loyalty and respect, that leadership can be taught, so can bearing, discipline, and honor. That follow me really does mean follow me. And that semper fidelis really does mean always faithful. And that the Marines hymn is so much more than just a song. My Marine experience helped shape who I am now personally and professionally, and I am grateful for that on an almost daily basis. And I often find myself wishing everyone had a similar opportunity to learn about shared dependence, loyalty, responsibility to and for others, about mutual respect and honor, and about the power of appealing to the best that's in us as human beings, not the worst. As a journalist, there has been one overriding effect of my Marine experience. While debates over sending Americans into harm's way are always about issues of foreign policy, geopolitics, and sometimes even politics, for me, they are also always about young lance corporals and second lieutenants and other very real people in all branches of the U.S. military. People with names, ranks, serial numbers, faces, families, and futures that may never be. When Marines stand for or sing the Marines hymn, as we will at the conclusion of this ceremony, it's never for ourselves personally. It's always for the Marines who went before us, with us, and after us. First and foremost for those who gave their lives, their health, their everything at places such as Tripoli, Belleau Wood, Haiti, Wake Island, Guadalcanal, Peleliu, Iwo Jima, Chosin, Incheon, Da Nang, Khe Sanh, Beirut, and Baghdad, Fallujah, and Ramadi. The death rate among Marines in Iraq has been more than double that of the other services. That's a first-to-fight, first-wave pattern that has pretty much held since the Revolutionary War, when 49 of the very first U.S. Marines of our country died in combat. Their mission was aboard ship. There are still Marines who serve at sea. There are others who fly and maintain jets and helicopters, man the artillery, operate tanks and trucks, feed and supply the troops, compute and collate, train and inspect, march and make music, recruit, guard and escort, radio and communicate, patrol and snipe, as well as save tsunami, earthquake, and other disaster victims around the world, collect toys at Christmas time for American kids in need, stage a marathon run through Washington, D.C. for charity, or do whatever else needs to be done, particularly if the need is for it to be done well and be done immediately. We are the Marines, and in the language of the rifle range, we are always ready on the right, ready on the left, already on the firing line. Whatever kind of firing is required, and wherever that line may be. Be ready now, one and all, to hail a moving force behind this wonderful museum. He is Lieutenant General Ron Christmas, United States Marine Corps retired. He served 34 years in the Corps and commanded at every infantry level. He is now the president of the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation, the organization that created this incredible place, this National Museum of the Marine Corps. General Christmas.
For a second time this morning, that is Jim Lehrer. And, you know, an infantry officer in the Marine Corps went on to be an incredibly respected journalist and moderator on PBS, PBS NewsHour, right? And he's one of the leaders of it. And but again, I what I most know about Jim Lehrer is that he was a Marine, and I think that experience characterized the way he approached journalism in an articulate, respectful way, respect for his adversary, right, and a devotion to the truth and to the nation. And he's a great example of what it is to be a Marine, and it's one of the coolest things about being a Marine is to be able to cross paths with guys like that and say that, you know, we walk the same path. And so the world's a poorer place without Jim Lehrer and his intellectual contribution to the nation. But we've learned over the course of decades to celebrate people's lives, and so we do that. So, again, my admonishment on a daily basis is no different today than it was yesterday, and that is to encourage you to go out and change somebody's life, to take the three goals and the Ten Commandments of post-traumatic winning, and don't be afraid to show them to anybody who struggles in life, anybody. And in changing their life, watch what you do to yours. So, in order to live the high life, you got to give, which is the third goal of post-traumatic winning. So download that shit to your phone and use it as often as you can. And don't be afraid to bust it out this weekend. Because, right, the path to the high life, is done by one, understanding you're never going to get over it, right? But you can live a good life once it enters your life. Two, you got to live a life with self-discipline. And on that note, you know, Chris Cox, who's in Hawaii, former Marine, you know, today sent me, you know, his weight is like 226. He's lost 11 pounds while he's on vacation, which pisses off a whole lot of other people who say that's impossible. Chris Cox used to weigh 500 pounds, right? And so it's him embracing the self-discipline that at one point characterized his life as a Marine that has brought him back to this place. So you got to live with self-discipline. And then the third goal that you have to embrace to live the high life is you got to give. You got to give the truth of this culture to people that are struggling and change their lives. And when you do that, you'll change your life. And that's how you get to the high line. So get after it this weekend. I'm going to do it right now during the show. Somebody called. They called on my personal phone. They called on the business phone. And then they texted me, hey. They didn't even give a name. I'll read you the text. Because I'm about to go change somebody's life. Okay. How's it going, Michael? I went to one of your seminars. And I'm just trying to reach out. Stand the fuck by, man. You're going to get reached out. And it's going to make this day awesome. So I would encourage you to do the same. All you got to do is listen. and you'll find them. On a Friday, Almarine Radio. Yeah, if you're just tuning in, today's show is a great show for no reason other than the personalities of the people that are here, the subject matter. So don't touch that dial. It's a great couple hours. Actually, it's 3 hours long. Holy shit. So we'll take a quick break. More of Almarine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.